You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
I'm Donna McKechnie, and this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take a 360-degree view of the theater through interviews with actors, writers, directors, designers, and everybody in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering marketing associate, personal chef, and event planner.
I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with Stage Left at NYC.
I'm Jennifer Samard, currently performing in Mean Girls on Broadway.
Hi.
Hi.
Here we are.
Yay.
Invalid in time.
Yes.
Oh, that doesn't sound good.
By the way, can we just talk about what my accent? Did I just say Broadway?
Broadway.
It was a little bit Broadway. On Broadway.
On Broadway.
Sometimes I say Broadway. Right?
Yes.
Right. Well, that's
like my trademark.
Yeah.
Broadway.
you make that emphasis on multiple
on
things.
A lot of things.
Yeah, that's like a Russo special.
I'll say it's part of my little jazz hand moment. You know?
Yeah, well, you can't see Rob's jazz hand, but maybe we'll take a photo. I'm going to Instagram that.
Well, today we have an incredible guest joining us.
That we do.
Donna McKechnie.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you guys.
Yeah, I can't even believe it.
I'm a little nervous. Mm.
I can't even, it's not even real to me that it's happening yet, because if I let it be real, then I will probably faint.
Oh, it's real.
I'm not nervous because she's just so lovely.
Yeah.
Every time I've...
You've worked with her before.
No, I've had the privilege of meeting her, and she has this warmth, I think, that enters the room first.
Oh,
you know, so
she's Donna McKechnie.
I know.
Lest we forget. As we were preparing and I was doing my research, I kept being reminded of the things that she had done. I mean, starting with How to Succeed in Business, like, wow, what a career.
Everything. I put this on social media a little while ago when we were first talking about having her come on. I was watching Music in the Mirror and I wept. I truly wept at the magic that was created on that stage. Mm. And I put that on social media thinking, you know, I'm such a fool. Turns out I'm not alone.
You're not alone.
Turns out it's a very common thing to weep at a chorus line. So there's a whole legion of us out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, should we get to it?
Let's get to it.
Today, we are thrilled to be joined by legendary dancer, singer, actor, choreographer, and all-around showstopper, Donna McKechnie. Donna's first Broadway show was the original production of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Of course, she went on to create roles in Promises, Promises, Company, and State Fair, winning a Tony Award for her iconic portrayal of Cassie in A Chorus Line, and being immortalized in the lyrics to I Want It All from the musical Baby. Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, Donna.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. That's
Did you know you were a lyric in a song?
I forgot about that, actually. I forgot about that, but it's a high compliment.
Yes. It certainly is.
Yeah. You're one of the three Donnas, right?
That's right, yeah. I was on the road touring, and somebody sent that to me, and I thought it was a just great high compliment.
So they didn't ask your permission, did they? No.
No, I guess I'm public now.
There you go.
After 50 years, it's like you're public.
Oh, that's funny.
Public domain, right?
I want to know that I can find inside me anyone I need. I want to be Donna McKechnie,
Donna Summer,
Donna Reed.
I want to be Margaret Sanger,
Margaret Thatcher.
I want it all.
I want it all.
Working backward towards your first show, which was How to Succeed in Business.
Yes.
Your choreographer on that was Bob Fosse, and I'm told
originally it was Hugh Lambert.
Oh, it was Hugh Lambert.
But, you know, as the Broadway, the tale goes, I mean, it was short-lived, and we loved him because he picked us, but then Bob Fosse was hired, and Gwen Verdon, who was between jobs, obviously, you know, was a great star, she was our dance captain. Fosse was so generous with Hugh. He said he would do it without pre-production if Hugh wasn't fired, if he was kept as choreographer. So at least he had the one credit for the pirate dance, which was kind of incredible. So that was that. And Fosse and Gwen, you know, Bob and Gwen just went, came in every day and worked at night, jumping up and down on their bed and, you know, re-choreographing it.
I love that they jumped up and down on their
bed. Well, that's what she said. Yeah. She told me that. I don't know what they were doing.
Everybody had a double meaning, right? That's funny.
Do you have a favorite story from working with them or a recollection of that time on that show?
I don't know if it's a favorite story. I just, the whole experience to me being my first show, and I came to New York in kind of desperate flight out of Detroit, and I wrote about it, and it's another story about the running away to become a ballet dancer, and showing my parents that I could survive because they wanted me to come back home, right? So I had to get a job. So I was one of those initially a ballet snob. Do you know what that is? The musical theater, it was all fear, but, you know, musical theater, I shouldn't do that. It's not good for my ballet, you know. But, of course, I was desperate to have a job, so I auditioned. And actually, I didn't audition. Cy Feuer hired me to do an industrial. And then on the steps in the back of a theater, the L'Enfantin, he said, would you like to do a Broadway show? We're going to do a show soon. Would you like to be in it? And I went, oh, sure. And I thought, this is how you get a Broadway show. A producer, you know, I soon learned that wasn't the case. But that was my story about Cy. You know, when I got into rehearsals, and when you have never done anything like this before, I was so stunned by what it turns out to be everyone in show business favorite, you know, being in the room with a collaboration of these great people, Frank Lesser, Abe Burrows. And Frank, I always say this, you know, was my first acting and singing coach, because he always said, do the gesture first, honey, and then sing the note. it works. I don't know why that is, but... So I was just in heaven with all these great people, and that's when they had a chorus of singers and dancers. So you had, 18 people in the room.
The dancers danced and the singers sang,
it was a
right?
chorus.
Yeah. Right.
It was... You had dancing boys, dancing girls, singing boys, singing girls. And you learned everything pre-tape recorder and hot rollers. What can I tell you? It was like Middle Ages, and you had to learn. But there's something of real value that we had that we don't have now, which I miss. And I understand it, but I still miss it, is the time, the luxury of being together in a group and learning the music, harmonies and everything together. Mm-hmm. So you're not rehearsing in your bedroom, you know, trying to make up for the next day. So we learned the show in the same room. And when you rehearsed, you know, you did it more than once when you went through something, you know, 5-6 times. All the good directors on Broadway would probably like to be able to have that time, but it's a constraint, you know. And Marsha Milgram Dodge is a wonderful director as well. And she just directed me and Andrea McArdle in a show that we're doing. And we talked about that. And she said, I have to choreograph, or if I'm directing, I have to do all my work, you know, really fast and furious. There's just no time. And, you know, I was a lucky girl to be able to work with him initially in my first show. And then, you know, meet and work with Michael Bennett and have all that wonderful, you know, experience collaborating with all of, you know, those, his camp. And I say camp because I never named it that way, but it was like, you know, are you a Fosse dancer or you a Bennett dancer? I go, you know, we're everything.
Yes.
But I was a lucky girl to be able to go back 25 years later and work with them again, you know, so that was a full circle.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned Michael Bennett just now. I believe you first met him on the TV show Hullabaloo in the 60s.
Yeah.
People have described you as...
That's coming back. Right. Oh, dear. Please don't. Courage Booths.
Some of it's on YouTube.
Right. I know. Thank God for YouTube, right. I think.
You're right. Well, people over the years have described you as being his muse, and he had referred to you himself as being his favorite instrument.
Oh, okay. I'll take that.
How do you react to these characterizations?
I don't know. I guess that's a really great compliment, especially if he says it. What I've evaluated in a way, you know, the great thing, the great gift he gave me and all of us in Chorus Line, you know, the collaborative, the sense of collaboration. And when we, you know, the truth is we were very similar in our dancing. And so when he had an idea or something he wanted to express, you know, in choreography, I felt very comfortable doing it. And he, I guess, appreciated that because our training was, you know, similar and our style was very similar. And of course, it's like finishing someone's sentence, and it's a great feeling. I'm very spoiled by the way he treated me. And when I worked with Ron Field, who was another great choreographer, he didn't work that way. So I kept, you know, getting in his way because he started choreographing something and I would kind of, you know, follow and add to it. And he'd say, "What are you doing?" You know, so I learned that quickly that, you know, let him do what he needs to do. And then everybody works in a different way. But Michael was very generous.
You just said the word collaborative. TikTok from Company was a number that was built specifically for you, correct?
And
it was designed and choreographed around your specific talents. Was that a collaborative effort as well with Michael?
Oh, yeah,
you both worked
on
that together?
It always was, yeah. Yeah, it was. Yes, it was. I'm stopping a little because, and another thing that I learned from Michael is that if it doesn't work, I mean, he will follow something through to make it work. And if it doesn't work, you know, he won't give up on it. And, you know, and my numbers, for some reason, because they were dance numbers that came out of left field and then were in for a while, they didn't work the first time out. That was the same with Promises as well and a Chorus Line. And then you find what the need is, what we have, mm-hmm. what's going wrong. It's almost like you have to try everything before you find the right the right combination of, or the elements that you're, what are you doing?
Was
you
that know? True for Turkey Lurkey Time, which is
yeah,
one of the greatest
oh my gosh,
numbers
we were,
of all, like, did you know it was going to be a sensation or did was it a
well,
slow burn?
Well, you know, that what I loved about it is that I love dancing so yeah. much. But there were years ago when I was trying to be, you know, when people would put you in a little category and I wanted to get acting jobs and I wanted to be a singer. I was studying all these things. And when I got Promises, was my first job to get as an actress and a singer. I wasn't mm-hmm. dancing in the show. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the first version of Turkey Lurkey was... well, I call it the audience reaction was Springtime for Hitler. We talked about it before because it was god awful. But the thing that's beautiful about it when you look back and after the success of it was that Michael was trying so hard to be truthful in his representation, you know. So the three secretaries that weren't dancers.
Miss Polanski of Accounts Receivable. Miss Wong of Mimeograph. And Miss Della Hoya of Petty Cash.
He said, well, you're in your, this is as if you are in your living room and you're making this up on your own. It's your choreography. So this is what we'll do. We'll push the desk together. We had the dancers push the desk together. We got up, climbed up. First night, opening night in Boston. And we had these stupid costumes that we made, supposedly.
Okay.
Very realistic. and the audience went, what? It's going, and Michael was in the back of the theater, in the Schubert Theater, I think, and he was running, and everybody was like melting. Oh, God. Mm-hmm. The end of the first act.
It's turkey lurkey time. Tom Turkey ran away, but he just came home. It's turkey lurkey time. He's really home to stay, never more to roam. Christmas.
said, I can fix it, I can fix it. And I love that image of him running back and forth saying, I can fix it. And that's kind of like what he did with a lot of his work, you know, because he was really reaching out, stepping out to try to do something different. Then the number became a show-stopping first act finale because he realized that, you know, it needed that thrilling, it's a musical, mm-hmm. it has to be above, and it needed as a background for Jerry Orbach's, you know, very bittersweet scene.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Now tell me about your neck, though. Was there a lot of chiropractic visits?
Oh, yeah, I have the, PT? Yeah. The,
right.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I don't go to chiropractors anymore.
No.
I've had too many adjustments in my neck,
gosh.
I think.
Oh, my gosh.
It's still there.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. Well, jumping forward a couple of years in the timeline, you were there for the famous sessions in January and February 1974. When Michael got a whole bunch of dancers together to talk about their lives and their experiences.
Yeah.
Do you remember those nights?
And, oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Was there at the time any sense that Michael had that this was, you know, geared towards becoming a musical? Or was it just an experiment? Was it an interesting...
I think it was a big experiment, right. But I think he was definitely determined to make it something important for artistically. And I think he had musical in mind. I mean, he made the statement because he didn't know. He said, I don't know if this is going to be a book, a movie, whatever, you know, I really felt that he wanted it to be, because I had been privy to efforts he made to create a musical about dancers before, and he was talking about using the idea of the Robin set for Afternoon of a Faun, something that a setting that could be an empty stage and dancers could walk in, and without any dialogue you could see the relationships, and that was a beginning of something, and so I knew that he had something in mind, so yeah.
Wow.
But nobody could have known, even Michael at that point, the direction, even after the workshop, it was awful. Not until they got focused, but by awful, I mean the result at that point, it was still kind of experimental, but elements of it were just brilliant. And that's what Joe Papp saw and championed it. because he saw the essentially what it was, and he had great feeling about it, and so that's it just kept growing. Yeah. Luckily,
well, that original cast is so iconic, not just because you know you all created the roles, but you know that image of the line, right, is just seared into everyone's you know idea of what Broadway is and what a chorus line was.
Yeah, can you imagine auditioning for those people,
right,
with your own dialogue that you said at the session?
Right.
You're reading your life and you're going, I don't know. And some people didn't get their part.
Right. Well, that was going to be my question, actually.
People didn't get it. Wow. And it's their life. So, but they did a tour or a national company later.
So everybody eventually got to play them.
Yeah.
Got to play their
lives. Like Mitzi Hamilton. Right. Yeah.
So there were auditions, though, for the ones that got up to the public.
That is a lot of therapy right there, right? Like I'm not good enough for my own life. What do you mean? Like, that sounds so strange.
You audition for your own life and you don't get it.
Rejected.
I know. Oh, my gosh. The ultimate rejection.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Tits. When am I going to grow tits?
Secrets. My whole life was a secret.
Goodbye, 12. Goodbye, 13. Hello, hello.
Robert Goulet, Robert Goulet, my God, Robert Goulet!
Whoa, down below, up on the wall.
I'm not girl with Evelyn.
La, la, la.
I'll show you mine.
La, la.
You show me yours.
La, la.
Seeing Daddy naked.
Time to grow. Time to go.
Cry.
La, la, la.
Mom and Dad were doing it.
What do you remember about that first performance at the Newman?
I remember that it was a relief and thrilling, and it was just because I called us the Hot House Tomatoes because we were so insular in our work. You know, it was like, and you just don't, you're just so, you know, at that point, and this is longer than any Broadway show I rehearsed for. This is going weeks and weeks and weeks, and we took a break and we came back and did weeks and weeks and weeks. So we were ready to open and our preview, and it was. I don't remember being elated or excited. I think I was, and I think the fact that there was acceptance. But then we had a hard road going through previews because changes were being made, and once they almost booed me off the stage because I came in like Betty Bacall, like I wasn't a part of the group, and waving a $10 bill saying, anybody got change for a 10? You know,
that was your entrance?
Yeah.
Wow.
I said, Michael, you are killing me. You're trying to make me like give me an entrance, and they hate me. It's like Charles Nelson Reilly. Remember him?
Of course.
Yes. Well, he was he was in How to Succeed. And I had an image of, at that point in time, of Charles coming off stage. After playing Frump, you know, and he would, part of his character, but he felt it. He would go, they hate me. They hate me. And I would be standing in the wings, you know. I kind of felt like that coming off in the beginning of a chorus line, you know.
Wow.
But, you know, you learn, if you're allowed to make mistakes, you learn. And then if you're smart and brilliant like Michael was, you know how to fix it.
Right, because Cassie famously didn't get the job originally, correct?
Yeah.
And that was another thing that was pointed out and then changed.
Because, again, he was trying to honor what he thought would be the truth of the situation.
Right.
He was brave enough to say that I wouldn't hire her. And a situation in his life actually happened like that. And he shared it with all of us the first night, or one of the nights, that this happened. Where he, a young dancer, well, she wasn't that young. She had already been in a starred in a movie. She came back to New York, and when he was choreographing the Milliken show, and she needed a job. And he looked at her and he said, I'm sorry, I can't hire you. You're overqualified. And she said, what? I need a job. Mm-hmm. And he said, I just can't have you in the room every day because I look at you and I will see failure. And he shared that with us, and I went, wow, that's how ambitious he was. But he was able to bring that feeling, that truth, into the story, which I thought was really, really, really brave. And so that he followed through on that. And then Marcia Mason, of course, was a famous story that goes around that she married to Neil Simon at the time, and he was helping us perk it up a little bit. She followed the through line of Cassie, and she said, "Oh no, you have to. She has to get it, because then nobody wins. Mm. Zach doesn't win. He doesn't learn anything, and she needs that second chance, and everybody does, you know."
Were you happy that that change was made?
Oh yes. Listen, if it would have worked for the show better the other way, I'm you know, it's fine. Right. That's what you do. You do what's right for the show. But when Marcia saw it, when Cassie didn't get it, that means that he was stuck in his unresolved conflict. And then the audience, whether they could analyze that or not, they were so depressed, they just walked out of the theater, you know, and it was a very strong feeling that everyone felt, so.
And clearly that affects the finale, right? That affects one.
It affects everything.
So it's a complicated thing.
You want a happy, that's why it's a beautiful human experience. You want a happy ending, but there's, you know, because Joyce Van Patten, who's a wonderful actress, was a friend. She saw it early on, and she said, "You know, I was so excited to see the finale. It was so beautiful." And then she goes, "Is that all there is? Is that it? Is that what they're doing this for?" Yes. It was just a great time, you know, just a great, great time. And then it progressively got even better, because everybody was then fraught with, is it going to move? Because sometimes when you move these beautiful pieces in a bigger venue, it doesn't work. Right? Yeah. And so it moved brilliantly. I mean, it was just, you know, so it just kept getting better. And now, I'll just bring you back to the moment. I'm excited because it's still going. I have a new podcast show, and I had, for my first show, was Kelly Bishop, Bjorkli, and Priscilla Lopez. And it was so funny because we were talking about how nobody really knew, you know, but as it went on. And now, Bjork, who has single-handedly, you know, taken Chorus Line around the world about 4 or 5 times, I got excited. I'm going to fly over because Antonio Banderas, mm-hmm. Okay?
Yes.
Yeah, gorgeous. He's playing Zach in Spanish. Wow. And he's, and it's the end of October. He has contributed to build a theater in his birth town of Malaga, Spain. And it's just being finished, and A Chorus Line will be the first musical, the first production in the theater. And Bjork's already over there. It has been over there auditioning and choreographing, and Louis Villabon, who is her assistant. And yeah, so, and I'm going to go see it.
When
but
does
look
it open?
At all these years. Oh, right. It's still going strong.
Yeah, it's a big full circle moment. Yeah. When does this production open?
I think October 25th.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I saw it at City Center last year. They did it for the gala.
Yes,
and
fabulous.
And it was like it was a brand new show. I mean, the audience reaction to
you went nuts for it. I remember
I
you loved
yeah.
it.
Oh,
yeah,
it's incredible.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Were you able to catch that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, my God, it was great.
Well, I'm curious to know, jumping forward again a little bit, in September 1983, A Chorus Line famously became the longest running show in Broadway history. And Michael produced that gala performance with, you know, all sorts of folks popping up throughout the night. And you danced The Music in the Mirror again with 8 other Cassies.
He brought companies from all over to participate. And we had, you know, the white tent covered all of Schubert Alley. The Booth Theater was all the dressing rooms. People dressed on the stage. You know, it was coordinated really well. Mm. They built steel things in the basement, you know, poles to hold the stage up, because at one point in the finale, there were over 400 people on stage doing, you know, hat up, no hat, no hat, hat, no hat, the legs and everything. And then the audience went nuts when all of a sudden dancers emerged from and came down the aisles and were following us and up in the balcony. And it was just incredible. It was just a great, I haven't seen anything before or since like that. It was just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
He knew how to put on a show.
Yes, he did.
Ooh, inside. Give her your attention. Do I really have to mention? She's on. She's on. She's on.
You were part of the legendary Paper Mill production of Follies in
1998. Yes,
and
yeah.
I hope you don't mind me reading you what Times critic Ben Brantley said about you. He said, Ms. McKechnie is beyond fault. The sweet, embattled overeagerness that has characterized her performances since her Tony-winning role in A Chorus Line has never been so appropriately or affectingly used, nor has her voice, which marvelously plumbs the torchy despair of the ballad Losing My Mind, ever seemed richer or more controlled. End quote. And you've said that Stephen Sondheim knew you as a singer first.
That's right.
So was playing Sally a nice homecoming of sorts, working on this Sondheim
show? Oh, I mean,
show?
It was... It was one of the greatest, you know, when you look back, when you've been in show business for a long time, you look back and there are just a few highlights, you know, and that certainly is one of them. Mm-hmm. My first audition as a singer was for Sondheim and George Abbott for A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, for the national company. Yeah. And when I auditioned for that show at Paper Mill, I never thought in a million years that they would see me as Sally. And I defeated myself when I went in because I was auditioning for Phyllis. But, and they were going to hire me as Phyllis because I'd just done it for the BBC at the Drury Lane, you know, as a recording. Mm-hmm. And so I felt very confident at that audition. And I could, Phyllis, okay, great. And then Sondheim said, no, she's Sally, she's not Phyllis. And to hear that he said that, I just burst into tears because it's like I thought he saw me and I wouldn't even let myself, that was my heart's desire and I couldn't even give it to myself.
I dim the lights and think about you, spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me, or were you just being kind? Or am I losing my mind?
It was just a wonderful experience. The whole cast. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are shows in your life, I'm sure you know, yes, that, you know, that there's usually a very loving group of people because we're all kind of pulling together, but that cast was exceptional. Lillian Montefecchi, Kate Ballard, Phyllis Newman, Ann Miller.
Does no one know it's like I'm losing my mind? Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you, spend sleepless nights to think about you. Or were you just
truly, outside of the original cast of Follies, I don't think you will ever find a better, more suited cast than the Paper Mill Playhouse cast. And that cast was exceptional.
Well, as a group, yes. Yeah. I mean, because they're individual. You know, it's like it's. I've seen some wonderful performances in that show, you know, from different people and different productions. But as a whole, right. That was, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah that was a great.
It was a glorious. I stood in the back of the theater that night because it was sold out. You couldn't get a ticket towards the end of the run. So I very fortunate.
And we got the recording. Yes. It was also a big heartbreak for everyone. I've learned not to to keep moving forward and not look back, you know. Mm-hmm. These things happen, rejection. But we had a... it was heartbreaking for Anne, for me, to see that she was so accepted. I mean, people loved her, and we had a theater, we had a producer, we had the money, and we couldn't move because of some glitch, and so it was dead except for the recording, and I think it just broke her heart, you know?
She wanted to come in to Broadway.
She knew that this, she knew that this would be her last show, and she wanted to go out in that great way, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, showbiz.
Speaking of showbiz,
yes, we are.
Right. I believe it was in 1980. You were diagnosed with arthritis and told that you would never dance again.
Oh, that's a big musical number right there.
Right?
Yeah.
Which calls to mind almost, you know, Zach's question in A Chorus Line: what do you do when you can't dance anymore? But what's
I didn't see that coming at that point in time, I'll tell you.
Right. Well, what's amazing is that you did dance again.
Yes.
Course, right. And very famously came back to A Chorus Line in 1986.
That's right. That's when I,
is no
when
easy
I,
feat.
Yeah. Pardon me?
It's no easy feat, you know, doing that number.
No.
I'm wondering, what was it like, especially having been in that original company and, you know, it was so iconic and such a sensation to come back almost more than a decade later.
It was scary for me because it would have been hard in any circumstance, but because I had been unable to not just dance, but not even move, not walk, you know, and to take myself through that journey and come out the other side of it. And then Bjork, who was my angel on earth, you know, called me in LA where I was living and said, you know, I have this tour going out, and I would love for you to do it. And I said, I haven't danced in so long. I was recovering, and I was back to, you know, class, but I just thought, that's it. And she said, I really want you to do it. And I said, well, I don't know if I can do it. And she goes, you have 3 months. She was like, Bjork, you know. And I went, okay. So she gave me the challenge, and I dove in, and so... It would have been hard anyway, you know, because 10 years later. But the things that you don't know that are positive were just so many. One that I gave, that show had been running for so long. So to go back to the same theater, the same production, except same costume, but different one, with a different cast, I gave them an opening night. In other words, my opening, had been doing it I don't know how long. They would just move them in, move them out. So they had a proper opening for the New York Times, and that was great. Mm-hmm. And it was a happy, because the show had been established, and it was a happy, happy time. The first time out, because we're doing that painful creating part and hits and misses, it was not always comfortable. Mm. There's a lot of strife, in and out, you know. So this was one of those great... chances. How many chances do we get really to go back and to do something again? As a woman, the positive thing was the fear started subsiding when I realized that I was a much more complete human being at that point. I was able to detach myself without trying to and leave the part in the dressing room and go have dinner with friends and have a great time, you know, enjoy my life. I had done enough work on myself, in other words. And also, physically, because I was more whole and more relaxed, my dancing was better. It was less frantic. It had more strength in some ways and stamina. Okay, you don't kick as high, you don't jump as high, you don't do, you know, turn as many times, but you gain something else. And the acting and singing was so much better. So
I love that.
Yeah, I was reading the oral history of course, Landa, the Longest Line book, and there's a section about your return. And, you know, every cast member that they talk to about it just raves about how it injected such an energy into the show and how what a lift it was for a show that had been running for
years. I was very grateful to have that chance, you know.
A chance to dance.
That's right, chance to dance.
Play me the music. Play me the music. Play me the music. Give me a chance to come through. All I ever needed was the music and the mirror and the chance.
You had brought up that you're hosting your own podcast, and I was wondering on the Broadway Podcast Network
Broadway
soon.
Podcast
That's right.
Network,
yeah.
And what can you tell us about it?
Well, it's called The Ladies Who Lunch, as of course,
excellent
title. We would know that that's an homage to our musical theater and Sondheim. And it's really kind of finding itself. But what I wanted it to be is to be at not retro, but like bring some of the good old days, the older in and being modern women. So I wanted to do it for, at this point in time, women who have had longevity in their career and have something to say and are still going strong. In other words, they're still working. Nobody has given. It might be the same for men too, but I'm a woman, so I'm speaking from that point of view. And I know in our popular culture of this country, you know, women, there's no playbook for how you negotiate your career after 55, 60. Mm-hmm. There's less work. You have to initiate. You have to redesign. You have to rethink, or you go from acting into directing. Or so I'm inviting women who have longevity and are, who do many things, not just actors, but writers, directors, anybody in show business. And it's at Sardi's, filmed at Sardi's. Like, it reminds me of those old days at El Morocco and the Stork Club when they would, you know, Sherman Billingsley. And I went, I got to get a little of that flavor, because after all, Sardi's is the heart of the theater district, and everybody goes there, or so many celebrations have happened mm-hmm. there, and so many of friends, old friends, are on the wall, and it's just a reminiscence. It's very nice. In the first show I did, I had all these questions, and of course I said the first question, asked them the first question, and they just went off, and I went, oh my God, women. They'll just, all you gotta do is like...
It's a thing. It happens. Yes. The more you prepare, the less you actually use.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's good.
And when does it start? When does it launch?
I think in September.
In September.
Sometime.
And
and
we should also point out that it's filmed and it's audible. So
that's
you'll
right.
be able to watch it and or listen to
right.
it depending on
right.
how you want to.
And
get
Matthew
your media.
Sklar, one of my favorite composers,
yes.
Did our little theme music.
Oh, that's great.
Oh my God, it's so adorable.
Well, we look forward to it.
I can't wait to subscribe.
Thank you for mentioning it.
I can't wait.
Of course.
Well, we have one final question that we ask everyone, and that question is, what was that thing that made you want to become an actor, become a dancer? Was there a moment?
I just remember the stories in A Chorus Line through another character, but I just, I think it's when I first heard classical music, or I heard any music, you know, Helen O'Connell singing, you know, the war songs on radio, and I would just get up and start dancing, just a little baby, you know, like 2-3 years old, and I just started moving to the music. And when I first went to my first little ballet class with folding chairs, you know, as the bar, and there was a screechy old record, you know, 78 of Chopin, and I heard that, and it was just, that changed my life, I think.
Well,
so
I'm glad it did, because it changed all of our lives.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This is great fun.
Thank you for coming down.
You're a wonderful guest. We're so honored to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. During our conversation with Donna, I mentioned that she first met Michael Bennett while working on Hullabaloo. You may be wondering, just what is Hullabaloo? I know I certainly did the first time I heard about it. Well, taking a step back in time to the 1950s and 1960s, you have to remember that variety shows and programs based around live performance were all the rage. Hullabaloo was a big-budget TV series that ran on NBC for two seasons, from 1965 to 1966. A variety show running in primetime, it was NBC's answer to the popular ABC show American Bandstand, hosted by Dick Clark, which no doubt you've heard of. Directed by Steve Binder, Hullabaloo was billed as a fast-paced song, dance, and comedy variety hour, showcasing young talent from Hollywood, Broadway, television, nightclubs, and recordings, and featuring a rotating celebrity host like Sammy Davis Jr., Frankie Avalon, or Liza Minnelli, who would perform a few of their own standards, then introduce a guest act like James Brown, The Supremes, or The Rolling Stones, a hit parade of the top 40 songs. Typical of such musical variety shows of the time, Hullabaloo had its own team of in-house dancers, four men and four women, known as the Hullabaloo Dancers, who performed on the show on a regular basis to choreography by David Winters, doing popular dances like The Jerk and The Monkey behind the guest act. Since the show filmed in New York, it's only natural that those dancers would be sourced from Broadway. And so it is that Donna McKechnie and Michael Bennett found themselves cast on Hullabaloo. After meeting, while doing The Jerk, Donna asked Michael what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he quickly shot back, a choreographer. Little did they know then that they were sowing the seeds for making musical theater history together. Not much video remains of the 48 episodes of Hullabaloo, but fortunately, the legacy of Donna McKechnie and Michael Bennett echoes forth to the present, a collaboration first forged in NBC's famed Studio 8H.
I mean, I can read it if you...
No, I'm happy to read it.
If you're done working.
No. Wow. Some shade in the pink room.
Shady lady.
Shade in the pink room. Okay. Jennifer here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.